Romans chapter 12 is where we are, and I put a title on this, as I typically would do to a lesson or a sermon, A Way of Thinking, A Way of Thinking. So I'm going to read Romans 12, 1 through 3, if you'll follow along in your Bible. Paul writes, I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. For through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. This section begins with exhortation. I urge you, my Bible says. You may have a Bible that says, I exhort you. There's an urging there. I'm begging you. And we saw last week, all of his begging, all of his urging, all of his commanding. And this begins the section of Romans where there are imperatives, commands are made. They all stand on a foundation that we have to always remind ourselves of, and it's right there in verse 1. It's by the mercies of God. Every action, every move springs from that central truth among Christians and among Christian churches. We do what we do by the mercies of God. It's a mercy that works. And to that end, it works toward what Paul tells us in verse 1 is a self-sacrifice. This mercy, if it is at work in you, it works this way, and it's a self-sacrificing mercy. There's a presentation of our bodies that Paul references that you cannot help but think about as the sacrificial system of the Old Testament. There is death in view, and what Paul has in view is the dying to self and the presenting then of ourselves alive in Christ. It's this picture of death that brings life, and now he wants us to live. And the way he wants us to live in sacrifice, we noted last week, two things. It's a living sacrifice, and it's a holy sacrifice. And the result of that, at the end of verse 1, is worship. So that's the beginning now of the Apostle Paul's journey from doctrine to application. His journey from all of these indicatives of the Christian faith to the imperatives of the Christian faith. We said last week, we don't assemble together when we assemble together. And it's not just worship, but if you picture the idea of Christians coming together, the church coming together, we don't do that to get. We do that to give. That's this foundational picture. We're a living sacrifice. We're not living sponges trying to suck whatever we can out of ministry and faith and association with Christians and even worship. So we talked about that last week. We talked about a faith that works. It would be easy if all we had was verse 1. That the Christian life is all about what we do in verse 1. This living, working, holy sacrifice. But the Christian life is not about what we do. So listen to me carefully, because my words are chosen carefully, because the Bible treats it carefully. If all you heard was the language of sacrifice and holiness and ministry and service, which is my translation, verse 1, yours may say worship, your reasonable worship. If that's all that we had in the Bible, then we would ultimately begin to see our sanctification, our life as Christians, ground in what we do. And when you do that, you quickly become Galatian. The Galatians had heard the gospel and then had false teachers come in and told them that from here forward now, it's about what you do. And principally, what they needed to continue to do was what the Jews had always done, and that's keep the law, keep the festivals, keep the rest of it. The Apostle Paul, who writes back to that church, says, I can't believe that someone has so easily come in and bewitched you. Did you begin, he says, by faith or by works? And the answer, obviously, is we began by faith. He then says, having begun by faith, would you now progress in the Christian life by works? No, it's faith. It's by the mercies of God. It's grace always. And yet still we are urged to accomplish what God calls us to accomplish. So if we stopped in verse 1, we become pretty tempted to be what we do. And the Christian life, the Christian testimony, begins to be dominated by what we do. But let me say it this way. I've said it this way many times over the years, because I think it makes the point succinctly, and I trust it's biblically faithful. The Christian life is not about what you do. The Christian life is about what you believe. And what you believe will affect what you do. All right? So the Christian life is never about what you do. It's about what you believe. And what you believe, according to Scripture and our understanding of how God put us together as human beings, what you believe will control and direct what you do. But if you get those out of sorts, if you get it twisted, you become twisted. And so Paul's not twisting us, and we're going to be careful here. This belief, this faith by grace, bound up in the truth, leads us to action. But the action itself is a response to and is fueled by the mercies of God. So now we're talking, Paul is, not about the justification that saves us, but the sanctification that preserves and matures us. Sanctification. And we're tempted to say, like the Galatians, well, now it gets to be about what we do. No, it's still going to be by the mercies of God. And that doesn't mean that what you do doesn't matter, but it's not going to be about that. It's going to be about what you believe. And to the point what Paul makes right away up front in verse 2, it's going to be about what you think. It's going to be about how you process and understand the truth about the mercies of God. So look at verse 2 again. The NASB begins this way. Do not be conformed to this world. The New International Version, NIV, maybe somebody has that. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. More words. NASB, do not be conformed to this world. NIV, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. The New English Translation, the NET Bible, do not be conformed to this present world. So what is all of that language? Why does it differ? What is Paul trying to say? Well, some might say he's simply saying, don't be worldly. Don't be worldly. Don't be conformed to patterns that you see in the world. And I would say that's good as far as it goes. Don't be worldly. Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold. You're a Christian now, and it's important that you be sensitive to and aware as you begin your sanctification. And we're like, if we take the book of Romans, we're like 12 words into our sanctification. It is really important that you understand this world. You cannot allow it to squeeze you into its mold. Christians have to resist that. Worldliness, again, the word. So let me ask this question as a means of trying to unpack this text. What do we mean by worldliness? And here's the idea again, friends. If you were raised in my tradition, where sanctification becomes about what you do, in part because justification was also about what I did. But certainly now sanctification is about what I do. It's what I do or what I don't do. Now, in this idea of not being pressed into the world's mold, not being conformed to worldliness, I was taught these things. Don't smoke. Don't drink. Don't chew. Don't date girls who do. Don't wear blue jeans. I was 15 years old before I had my first pair of blue jeans. We weren't allowed to have them. So if I read, don't be squeezed into the world's pattern, and I believe my sanctification and Christian life is about what I do, then that's how it's going to end up. I don't do this, I don't do this, I don't do this, I must do this, I must do this, I must do this, but I must not do that. And as you can quickly see, it becomes not by the mercies of God, but by the laws of man. That's what it very quickly becomes. Turn over to 1 Peter and find chapter 4 real quick. 1 Peter chapter 4. Because I don't want you to think that none of those things have anything to do with the Christian life. So 1 Peter chapter 4. He's talking to Christians here, and he says in verse 3, the time already past is sufficient for you. In other words, there's been enough time to carry out the desire of the Gentiles. And there we mean non-Jews, and there Paul would reflect to the Greek culture writ large, worldliness. I should say Peter, the world. Okay? It's already past for you to carry out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued, you've already done this, a course of sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. And in all this, as you realize that the time has passed for you in all this, in all of this, they are surprised that you, as a Christian, do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and therefore they will malign you. That's worldliness. It is the way you used to walk before you were a Christian, evidenced in the things you do. And it is Peter the Apostle saying, you don't do those things anymore. And then the world is surprised because you don't do those things anymore. That's what Peter is saying. That's worldliness as it regards what you do. But please hear me. That aspect of worldliness is not what Paul is talking about in Romans 12. And I want to show you that. So go back to Romans 12 and back to verse 2 and look at the second phrase. Be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Paul is talking about here the world and worldliness as a way of thinking. And he is saying, as a Christian now, you need to understand that there's world think. And that world think will seek to conform you into thinking that way, because even the world knows, as a man thinks, so is he. And that's what Paul is talking about here as it regards worldliness. A way of thinking, not so much a way of behaving. Again, not that he sees those as opponents of each other. He's simply placing the priority, 14 words or so into your sanctification, that you understand that where the world will threaten you is to conform you to their way of thinking. And you cannot do that. You need to experience a transformation, a real change, and it starts with a way of thinking, because the thinking will lead you. The thinking always leads you. Behavior will follow the thinking. Behavior that precedes thinking will inevitably stop because you won't think it's necessary. We won't belabor that. Okay, so Paul is not saying that the Christian should have no concern or no connection with the world. Nowhere does the Bible teach that. But he is saying that as it concerns the world, as it concerns, we might say, the secular reality that's all around us, that we cannot be consumed by that, absorbed by that, conformed to that, that we can't let it press us into its mold. We have legitimate concerns about the secular world. We should have. We have legitimate direction in Scripture concerning the things of culture, concerning secular things. But they cannot be the priority. It's not that we take no interest, but we can't take a prevailing interest. Because to take a prevailing interest in the secular think or the or the world's machinations means that my interest is in changing that, and therefore I'm trying to change through conformity something on the outside without changing on the inside the way they think. And we know as Christians, Paul would say, God would say, that won't work. You can't just conform people. We're looking for transformation, not just in ourselves, but in our world. And that transformation requires a new way of thinking, not a new way of behaving. We can't compel behavior and not change the way people think. So we got to be careful that secularism and our desire to not be conformed, but rather to transform the world around us doesn't become our motive, as if that's all there is. Is that a threat? It's a constant threat. It's a constant threat that Christians and the Christian church will behave as if changing the world and the secular culture is all that there is. And it's not all that there is. The spirit of the age then becomes the priority, and we will use the age's reason and the age's approach and the age's pattern to try to change that. And to the degree that we do that, we've moved away from the only thing that can produce any real lasting transformative change, which is the thinking about God and the gospel. So we have to be careful. I remember Carl Sagan. Who's old enough to remember Carl Sagan? I love it. The church gets younger every year, and my illustrations, I got to work on new ones. Well, he kind of introduced us in the 70s and 80s into this idea of the cosmos. He was one of these higher intellectuals, and what I remember about him still, and I did YouTube this yesterday, so I'm not so behind, to make sure that what I remembered was real, because I don't always trust my memories. But he was the guy that had this way of saying billions. Billions and billions of planets and billions of galaxies. There is a 5-minute mashup of him saying billions on YouTube that's worth the time if you're old enough to remember him. Quote, Carl Sagan, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." That's foundational secularism. But this is all there is. This is it. Turn to Luke chapter 12 and you'll see that Jesus illustrates in a parable that kind of thinking and how reckless it is. He's telling a parable, Luke chapter 12. It's a parable, if you've got a study Bible, the heading probably says the rich fool, and that kind of gives you an advance into what he's going to talk about. Verse 16, he told them a parable. "The land of a certain rich man was very productive, and he began reasoning to himself," you might circle that word reasoning, thinking to himself, saying to himself, "Self, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?" And so he said, again to himself, "This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods." And watch, thinking and speaking to himself, not just like some mental exercise, but as a reflection of his conviction. Because he says, "I'll say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." Secularism. That's all there is. And I got lots of it. So I'm going to store it up. And with the eager anticipation and even confidence that I have enough. And that is a reflection, notice, of the very being of this man. It's his soul's conviction. But God said to him, "You fool. This very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." You're focused on the cosmos. as though that's all there ever will be. And God speaks into that secular way of thinking and says, that's just foolish. Because just like that, you're going to move from the cosmos to the reality of eternity. And you're going to learn that what is not all there is. And more than that, you'll learn that what is one day won't be. All right, so it's there. Our Lord teaches about it. If now is all that matters, then why do I need to think about anything else? There are always some young people in here, and I see a few young people in here. And if I could go across the parking lot over there, I would say to them in this context, don't fall to the lie that says school doesn't matter. Why does school matter if this is all there is? Why do that? Why a career? Why? And then spirituality comes along. Why righteousness? Why? Sin? Who wants to talk about sin? Judgment? I mean, this is all there is. Why should we even bother thinking about those things? Why shouldn't we just be like this man? Eat, drink, and be merry, which, by the way, was a Greek philosophy. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we what? We die. This is all there is. R.C. Sproul writes this, for secularism, all life, every human value, every human activity must be understood in the light of this present time. What matters is now and only now. All access to the above and the beyond is blocked. There's no exit from the confines of this present world. The secular is all that we have. We must make our decisions, live our lives, make our plans, all within the closed arena of this time, the here and the now. Now, if you don't think that's the dominant thinking of the world, then you're not thinking. It's only with that foundational thinking can anybody think that murdering their child is a reproductive health. You can't get there until you start here. Now is what matters. And I could go on and on there, right? That's that, so that you understand, if we're not careful as a church, we want to fight those battles without addressing the foundation that has produced all of this. And it's fundamentally secularism. It's my life. It's my day. I will live it like I want to live it. Because nothing else is. Nothing else is. But there is something else. Harry Blamires writes this, to think secularly is to think within a frame of reference bounded by the limits of our life on earth. It's to keep one's calculations rooted in this worldly criteria. To think Christianly is to accept all things with the mind as related directly or indirectly to man's eternal destiny as the redeemed and chosen child of God. That's a different way of thinking. That what matters here doesn't matter most. What matters most is the life ahead. What matters most is, am I positioned for eternity, realizing with the wisest man who ever lived, named Solomon, that my life lived here, whether it be 100 years or 150 or 800 like Methuselah, is just a vapor. It is just a wisp. And you cannot be consumed with that. And the temptation is there. So look at the text again in Romans 12. And there's some more interesting insight into this when Paul says, do not be conformed. We tend to miss this in the English, and I can't point you to an English translation that won't on its surface seem to miss it. But this helps, and this will be very much like your own Bible. We read, do not be conformed. Listen, it does not say do not conform. Okay? Hear the difference? Do not be conformed is different than do not conform. In other words, the be acknowledges an external force. Don't let something move against you in conformity. The English Bibles work at that, not because the word be is there in the Greek, because it isn't. The only word there in the Greek is the word syskematizo. A schematic. a pattern. But that word in the Greek is in the passive tense. Something is happening to you. You're passive in it. In a Greek lexicon, quote, "It is very telling to the Greek student that being conformed to the present world is a passive tense notion, because this suggests it may happen, at least in part, subconsciously." I agree with that 100%. And my life is evidence of it, and your life is evidence of it. This happens without you knowing it. This world begins to work on you in ways that you do not recognize. And it is pressing you and shaping you into a schematic that is absolutely opposed to God's plan and pattern for living. Some have called it world creep. It sneaks up on you. And it's out there all the time, constantly. We see things that are here, and we miss the things that are there, because the world doesn't believe there's a there there. Sometimes it's called thought drift. Sometimes it's called mind drift. The Bible speaks of it with these words: you're being carried along. Look at Ephesians 2 quickly. Ephesians 2, verse 1. "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins. Yet dead," notice verse 2, "you walked." Okay, you were dead. That's a spiritual condition. And in that condition, you walked. You formerly walked. How did you walk? In accord with the course of the world. You were being moved along. Oh, so much talk of independence. No, you're being moved along according to the course of this world. That word course is aeon. It's the same word in the Greek in Romans 12. Don't be conformed to this world. This aeon. This age. Not dirt. According to the aeon of this cosmos. That's that phrase. You're moving along according to the age of this cosmos. The here and now. This is all there is. And before you came to Christ, you had no resistance to that. You were just drifting with it. That's what we speak of when we speak of this idea of mind think, that this mind drift, I should say. Go to Ephesians 4 and look at verse 14. Here he's reflecting now that you're a born again Christian. And he says, verse 14, "As a result, we are no longer..." Now he takes you back to before you were a Christian. Or even now as a Christian, you can no longer do these things. Look at it. You can no longer be children. You can no longer be tossed here and there by waves. You can no longer be carried about by every wind of doctrine. You can no longer be moved by the trickery of men. You can no longer fall to craftiness in deceitful scheming. You can no longer do that. What do I have to do that? Answer: nothing. You don't have to do anything to do that. You'll just be carried along. By what? By the age, by the eon of the cosmos, by the thinking of the world. That's what Paul speaks of when he says, don't be conformed. Don't let it move you. What do I have to do? Nothing. And it'll move you. So that verse has the positive response, which we'll get to next week. Now do something. Do something. Don't just sit there. Because if you just sit there and you let your mind think and then be conformed to the way the world thinks, then inevitably you'll act the way they act. Because as you think, so you do. Now we have to be careful here, again, that our desire not to be conformed doesn't get supplanted with the desire to make you conform. Always threatens the church. Always. R.C. Sproul's words here, we have to be very careful with this business of conformity. I would echo that. He goes on, be very careful with this business of conformity and nonconformity. We are by nature conformists. We tend to pinpoint the drive to conformity among those passing through adolescence, like it's the teenagers who are being moved along. Sproul says, no, we're conformists from the time we're born until the time we die. It's a part of the human condition. We always feel peer pressure. It won't go away. We always feel the tug and the struggle to be in line with contemporary taste and worldly standards. We'll always feel that. That's why watching contemporary culture, consuming yourself with its customs, is a dangerous way for a Christian to live and to educate their own conscience. Because it's changing you and you don't realize it. It's changing you at the fiber of who you are and you don't realize it. They aren't first thoughts that you shape that are contrary or conforming, contrary to the gospel, conforming to God. They are thoughts not shaped, but shaped for you. Thoughts thought for you. So you don't have to think. You hear that message in the culture? So you don't have to think. I've thought about this for you. Sproul would go on to say, the other danger is to recognize that nonconformity can be as vicious a trap as conformity. There is such a thing as nonconformity for nonconformity's sake, because we all want to be different. And in that group, we want to stand out. And in that group are Christians who are quick to distort the point. Christians and Christian ethics always determined by the antithesis. What does that mean? If the world wears lipstick, I'm not wearing lipstick. If Christians wear lipstick, then they're worldly. If the world goes to movies, I won't go to movies. If the world goes to a restaurant where there's a lounge, I won't go to that restaurant. If the world goes to the lounge, I won't go. I love what Sproul says. That's nonsense. It's nonsense. It's not Christian. It's not spiritual. It's nonconformity for nonconformity's sake. Because what's missing is your thinking. You're not thinking. It's like the Christian that goes to the beach. They can't wear a bikini. I'm not making a point about that. I'm just making a point. So they wear their "What Would Jesus Do?" sweatshirt. And that's nonsense. It's nonsense. Oh, you'll stand out for the fool that you are on a 100-degree day in a sweatshirt. So you get the idea? This idea of conformity and nonconformity can be a tricky one, and it is always tricky when it's applied at the point of what you do, which is not Paul's point. Paul's point is, you have got to change the way you think. You have no possibility of transformation unless you change the way you think. The rest of it is just behavior modification. Engage the mind, he says. Romans 12 again. I got to find it in my Bible. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind. For what reason? Look at it. So that you can prove what the will of God is. So that you can discern. So that you can know how one ought to behave. That which is good. That which is acceptable. And that which is perfect. Learn how to test things. Learn how to discern things. Find out what God's will is. And then live that way. Motivated by what you think and how God directs your thoughts. By the time we get to Romans 14 in a while, Paul's going to acknowledge that all Christians won't think the same way about everything. We won't all think the same way about everything. Outside the essentials of the gospel, where there is no room for disagreement, there must be room for disagreement about a lot of other things. And guess what he's going to say? Let's come up with a standard and let's all live by that standard. Let's take a vote and we'll all do the same thing. That's not what he's going to say. He's going to say, be fully convinced in your own mind. Because a man, right? A man compelled to do something against his will is still unconvinced. And inevitably won't do it.